This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. says it will keep up pressure on the leadership of Yemen's Ansarullah days after announcing it would revoke the terrorist designation of the movement. Myanmar's anti-coup protesters take to the streets for the fourth straight day, defying warnings from the military threatening action against them. A UN report shows North Korea maintained and developed its nuclear and ballistic missile programs throughout 2020. Thank you for joining us. The U.S. says it will keep up pressure on the leadership of Yemen's Ansarullah days after Secretary of State Antony Blinken told Congress he intends to revoke the terrorist designation of the movement.
That I think we will certainly keep up the pressure on the leadership of the Ansarullah movement, of the Houthis. We can do that without the sort of broad designation, the two designations that I spoke to.
The State Department spokesman said the U.S. will continue to stand with Saudi Arabia in the face of what he called attacks from Ansarullah, but the official fell short of touching upon the kingdom's deadly war on the Yemeni people that began in March 2015. He claimed that the aim of Blinken's plan to delist the movement is that the U.S. doesn't want to add to the suffering of Yemeni civilians. Former President Donald Trump blacklisted the Ansarullah movement only days before leaving office. The United Nations and humanitarian organizations had warned that the designation will push millions of Yemenis into a large-scale famine. Political commentator Yusuf Mowry says Saudi Arabia and its Western allies want a puppet regime in Yemen to control the country.
Saudi Arabia is waging this war because they're being supported by the U.S. The U.S. is insisting that Saudi Arabia maintains its offensive in Yemen. Because Saudi Arabia and the U.S., they have a common goal in Yemen. They want to rid the Yemeni people from any source of legit authority, Yemeni authority that would only implement the demands of the Yemeni people. What Western powers, what Saudi Arabia wants in Yemen is a puppet regime. That's why they have the Hadi government stationed in Saudi Arabia. That's why the former president, Hadi, is basically just getting orders from Saudi Arabia and signing any paper that comes across his table from the Saudi regime. They, you know, in a nutshell, the simplest way to say this is because it's the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Western powers will continue to fuel instability in Yemen until they get what they want. And what they want is a puppet regime that takes orders from Saudi Arabia. They want a Saudi puppet regime to control the affairs of the Yemeni people and to keep the Yemeni people under Western supervision.
The U.S. and Iran remain stuck in a standoff, with each asking the other side to comply with the 2015 nuclear deal. Washington has once again called for Tehran's full compliance with the accord first before it takes a step.
If Iran comes into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same, and then use that as a platform to build a larger and stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern. That would, of course, be done with our P5+1 partners, as it was done.
The White House press secretary made the comments a day after President Joe Biden said Washington will not lift sanctions unless Tehran reverses the scaling back of its commitments under the deal. Iran, however, says it was the U.S. that unilaterally abandoned the agreement and therefore must take the first step by complying with its obligations, which include the removal of sanctions. Tehran has also stressed that it will never renegotiate the nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran is set to begin human trial of its second homegrown COVID-19 vaccine next week. Developed by the country's oldest scientific research center, Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute, the COVPARS vaccine is based on a recombinant protein that can be injected or inhaled. Salman Khajuri reports.
The head of Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute says the Razi COVPARS vaccine will be an excellent option as it is the first injectable inhaled COVID-19 vaccine of recombinant protein. Dr. Ali Sari, speaking at the press conference, said the vaccine produced by the Razi Institute of Iran does not contain any elements other than the ingredients required for the vaccine.
The 96 years experience of the Razi Institute is the backbone of the Razi COVPARS vaccine production, and this vaccine must pass the relevant tests, and the media should assure the audience that the vaccine produced does not contain any negative side effects. Currently, Razi COVPARS vaccine has been prepared for human injection, which will begin with the issuance of a license by the Food and Drug Administration of Iran.
The press conference came only one day after Iran unveiled its second domestically made vaccine titled Razi COVPARS. Razi COVPARS is administered in three stages, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart and an intranasal administration 30 days after the second jab. Developers say not only does this protect the recipient from the virus, but it prevents them from transmitting the virus to others. Those who receive the COVPARS vaccine will not need a mask anymore.
The country has the ability to produce all three types of the coronavirus vaccines, including those with the technology of African virus, inactivated virus, and mRNA. Razi COVPARS is one of the safest vaccines with very few side effects, and it will stop the recipient from transmitting the virus to others.
Domestic rival Iran's first homegrown vaccine, COVID-1, is ahead in schedule and will start the second phase of the human trial next month. At the same time, Iran has imported the first batch of Russia's Sputnik V and will kickstart its mass vaccination this week. The first phase of the human trial of COVPARS will begin next week on 130 volunteers. Developers say the entire human trial will take some 5 months. Salman Khajuri, Tehran.
Anti-coup protesters have taken to the streets of Myanmar's largest city, Yangon, for a fourth straight day in defiance of new bans. Fresh protests took place in various parts of Yangon, including near the headquarters of the National League for Democracy. That's the party of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. She's been in detention since the army seized power last week. Protests have been held in different parts of Myanmar calling for Suu Kyi's release. The military has now banned gatherings of more than five people. It has also imposed night curfews to quell the demonstrations. The military staged a coup over alleged fraud in November's elections that Su Qi's party won by a landslide. Political commentator Myra Dagapa says Myanmar's military junta is unlikely to call an election anytime soon.
Honestly, I am very doubted. And what worries me most is another how many years of military dictators. I mean, we look at the 1988, the second military coup that took us all the way from then until 2010. And I'm just hoping that it doesn't take us that long, and hopefully it is not more than a year. I have no idea, and nobody knows except he himself. Because the problem is that he wants that power. He has very high political ambition as well as economic ambition. So he's only one who knows the answer of when and where he'd like to hold the election at this point. That is why we called him the military dictator.
The United Nations says North Korea keeps developing its nuclear capabilities in violation of international sanctions. According to a confidential UN report seen by media, Pyongyang produced fissile material, maintained nuclear facilities, and upgraded its ballistic missile infrastructure throughout 2020. The report also said the North continued to seek material and technology for its programs from abroad. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump met three times in 2018 and 2019, but failed to make progress on Washington calls for Pyongyang to give up its nukes and North Korea's demands for an end to sanctions. The new U.S. administration has said it is planning a new approach to deal with North Korea. U.S. Democratic prosecutors overseeing the impeachment trial of Donald Trump say the former president committed the most grievous crime in his last days in office. The nine House impeachment managers said Trump's incitement of insurrection against the U.S. government, which disrupted the peaceful transfer of power, was the highest constitutional crime. They also called the evidence about the former president's misconduct overwhelming. In the meantime, Trump's lawyers have denied charges that he incited his supporters to attack the Capitol building last month. In a brief published on the eve of trial proceedings in the Senate, Trump's defense team branded the unprecedented second impeachment as a political act. They argued that the Constitution does not allow for such a trial for former president. And the U.S. Senate or state of Georgia has opened an investigation into former President Donald Trump's alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential elections results there. Georgia's Secretary of State's office has launched the probe. The office had faced calls to do so following a phone conversation recorded on January the 2nd. During the phone call, Trump asked Georgia's Secretary of State to, quote, find enough votes to change the state's election result. Legal experts say Trump's move may have violated at least three criminal election laws. They say the violation of the laws could be punishable by fines or imprisonment. The former U.S. president has insisted that he lost the November vote because of fraud. And thousands of Argentinians have hit the streets of the capital, Buenos Aires, to protest against the worsening economic situation in the wake of the coronavirus crisis. The protesters voiced their anger at the government of President Alberto Fernandez over its mishandling of the pandemic. They also demanded jobs and better pay while marching on the economy ministry, waving flags and chanting slogans. The Latin American country has been hit hard by the pandemic, exacerbating its already ailing economy. According to United Nations data, millions of people have been driven into poverty, with almost 6 out of every 10 children and adolescents below the poverty line. The country has so far recorded nearly 2 million coronavirus cases and nearly 50,000 related deaths. The health crisis is expected to shrink the country's GDP to around 12% this year. Venezuela has denounced the U.S. and Canada for stockpiling COVID-19 vaccines. This comes as Caracas is struggling to contain the coronavirus outbreak due to a shrinking economy hit hard by unilateral U.S. sanctions. Our correspondent in Caracas tells us more.
The government of Venezuela is ramping up efforts to obtain coronavirus vaccines to inoculate its population, despite the ongoing economic crisis prompted by a series of tough U.S. sanctions. Although Venezuela has so far succeeded in keeping infections fairly low with regular lockdowns, the nation is still facing many challenges due to Washington's harsh restrictions. In this context, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza has slammed the rich countries in the Americas, namely the U.S. and Canada, for hoarding COVID-19 jabs. Arreaza remarked that this harmful policy is depriving other countries in the region of enough vaccines. He said this is a tantamount to putting political and commercial interests above human rights. Venezuelan officials back Arias's argument.
Venezuela will fight legally against the monopoly that the U.S. and its allies are purportedly trying to establish over COVID-19 vaccines.
However, some opposition members have a different opinion.
If the U.S. and Canada have more access to vaccines, it is because they are democratic countries and Venezuela is not.
But experts say that Venezuela is in fact a democratic nation and deserves free access to vaccines.
Venezuela has the same rights to the coronavirus shots as any other nation, since politics shouldn't meddle with humanitarian issues.
While the Maduro government works to guarantee a proper vaccination process for all the Venezuelans, it also has to deal with a round of U.S. sanctions that hinder the access to such vaccines in the region. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
An investigation has found that French police played a role in the death of a young black man while in custody 5 years ago. A report from four Belgian doctors commissioned by investigating magistrates showed a pinning of Adama Traoré to the floor by officers could have contributed to his death. The doctor said the victim had very likely suffered a heat stroke. Traoré died in July 2016 while in custody after being restrained and apprehended by the police. The report comes amid French government's attempts to increase public confidence in law enforcement agencies following repeated scandals of racism and brutality. Traoré's death in custody had also sparked widespread protests across France against police brutality. Palestinians in the blockade Gaza Strip have expressed their solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners who continue to languish in Israeli prisons. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a sit-in in front of the Red Cross office to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights, including access to proper medical care during the coronavirus pandemic. Last month, Israeli regime forces arrested 456 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including women and minors. Hamas movement demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
Zionist practices against Palestinian prisoners violate all international laws and norms. We came here to express a united stance in solidarity with the prisoners. We call on all international organizations to intervene and protect Palestinian prisoners, especially during the coronavirus pandemic.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. The plight of Palestinian prisoners has increased amid the coronavirus pandemic. Around 400 of them have been infected with a deadly virus.
We call on the International Committee of the Red Cross to help Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. We are deeply concerned over the prisoners who suffer from medical negligence. More and more prisoners are infected with the coronavirus because of the overcrowding and lack of hygiene products.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Continuing the resistance is the key to liberate the prisoners, including by capturing Israeli soldiers to swap them with Palestinian inmates. We also need to increase solidarity activities to support the prisoners and highlight their suffering in Israeli prisons.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Currently, thousands of prisoners are kept inside Israeli jails, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A new study shows a coronavirus variant first detected in Britain is rapidly spreading in the U.S., threatening to bring a surge of new cases there. The study by a team of scientists led by researchers at the Scripps Research Institute gives a grim picture of more contagious COVID strain in the country hit hardest by the pandemic. The team has analyzed 500,000 test samples collected from across the country since last summer. According to the findings, the new variant doubles roughly every 10 days, and its proliferation could worsen the situation. So far, COVID-19 has claimed nearly 465,000 lives out of over 27 million cases in the U.S. On Sunday, Republican Congressman Ron Wright also succumbed to the disease, becoming the first sitting member to lose his life after battling the coronavirus. Well, that's your War Looms for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things: leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless thou repelst him. By means of, in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The limelight.
Iranian sovereign independence threatens U.S. imperial interests by encouraging other nations under its yoke to break free. The U.S. NATO-Israeli regime and their imperial partners threaten regional and other nations worldwide that won't sacrifice their sovereign rights to a purported higher power in Washington. The article you're about to hear has been authored by Stephen Lenman, a Chicago-based author, research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization, and host of the Progressive Radio NewsHour. The piece is titled, Islamic Revolution of Iran Threatens U.S. Imperial Interests. Please stay with us for more of Stephen Lenman's article. The 10th of February marks the 42nd anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. It ended a generation of U.S.-installed tyranny that deprived Iranians of their fundamental rights. Iran regained control over its sovereign independence and natural resources, the U.S. no longer able to plunder them. For Iran and its brave and faithful people, there is no turning back to control by a repressive foreign power and its installed puppet regime. Iranian sovereign independence threatens U.S. imperial interests by encouraging other nations under its yoke to break free. The U.S., NATO, Israeli regime and their imperial partners threaten regional and other nations worldwide and won't sacrifice their sovereign rights to a purported higher power in Washington. In late 1947, Iran demanded more revenue from its own oil. The Anglo-Persian Oil Company, APOC, refused. In 1951, 1 month before Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh became Prime Minister of Iran, Parliament nationalized the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Supposedly, fair compensation was paid. Iran tried but couldn't resolve its revenue-sharing dispute. Imperial USA and Britain then and now want unchallenged control over Iran, its resources and its people. Economic sanctions and an oil embargo followed back then. British banks froze Iranian assets. Major Anglo-American oil interests supported London. Today's anti-Iranian repression by the United States is much like what occurred then in new form. In 1953, CIA operative Kermit Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt's grandson and Franklin's cousin, engineered the agency's first ever coup. Democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh was ousted. At the time, the New York Times called him the most popular politician in the country. Nonetheless, a military showdown followed against pro-Mossadegh officers, with each side staking their careers on the outcome. He was deposed. Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi replaced him. Sanctions were lifted, the US and Britain regaining an Iranian client state until February of 1979, when the same Anglo-American interests were cut off by the revolutionary Iranian people and Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi was removed from power. As late as 1977, Jimmy Carter called Iran an oasis of stability. He ignored years of brutal regime repression. In January of 1979, things came to a head. The Shah fled the country. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, returned from exile in Paris and proclaimed the Islamic Republic with overwhelming public support. American officials, however, thought that they could control him and Iranian oil, but they miscalculated. Free from Western dominance, Iran didn't look back to this day. Tensions built over time. They reached a boiling point during President Donald Trump's tenure that included all-out U.S. war on Iran by other means, short of things turning hot. Since Iran regained its sovereign independence, it's been targeted by the United States and its imperial partners for regime change. Iranians reject the notion of U.S. and Western control regained over their country. Annually, Iranians commemorate the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Nothing like it ever occurred in the United States. When people have nothing to celebrate, they don't. Years of protests were needed for meager social gains. Racism and class divisions defined the United States from inception up until today. Constitutional law legitimized slavery. Blacks were commodities, not people. Only adult white male property owners could vote. Women were considered childbearing, homemaking appendages of their husbands. Except for the U.S. ruling class, other adult white males couldn't vote until property and tax requirements ended in 1850. States elected senators until the 1913 17th Amendment enfranchised citizens. Native Americans had no rights at all until the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act. It partially returned what no one had the right to take away in the first place. Today, Native Americans are treated like serfs, not U.S. citizens. Women's suffrage wasn't achieved until the 1920 19th Amendment, after nearly a century of struggle. The 1865 13th Amendment freed black slaves. The 1870 15th Amendment gave them what wasn't achieved until passage of the landmark mid-1960s Civil and Voting Rights Acts. They abolished long-standing Jim Crow laws, now re-emerged in new forms. Today, virtually all hard-won gains are lost. African Americans have no reason to celebrate. Neither do Latinos and all working Americans exploited by corporate predators complicit with both right-wing of the U.S. one-party state. Early America was repressive and unfair. Today, things are much worse. Democracy is a pure fantasy in the United States. It exists for the privileged few alone that benefit by exploiting ordinary people at home and abroad. Freedoms are eroded en route to disappearing altogether. On 20th of January, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris replaced Donald J. Trump. Looking ahead, things are more likely to worsen than improve. Diverging from the official narrative increasingly is considered a threat to national security. Speech, media, and academic freedoms are threatened. Censorship, the new abnormal. nations free from U.S. control are targeted for regime change. Favored U.S. tactics include war by hot and or by other means. Joe Biden called on Congress to pass the repressive Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act. If enacted into law, it will be another nail in the coffin of disappearing freedoms in the United States, by targeting for elimination what free and open societies hold dear. When dissent is redefined as terrorism, censorship becomes the new abnormal, along with totalitarian rule. That's where the United States is heading. As for relations with Iran and other nations from U.S. control, normalizing them is considered a threat to America's national security. Whatever the fate of the landmark Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action ahead, U.S. relations with Iran and other nations free from its control will remain hostile. No matter which wing of its war party runs things, the United States can never be trusted, because sooner or later it will breach whatever it has agreed to. I see nothing ahead that encourages me to believe positive change in how the United States operates is possible.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
...1979, Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the gas prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the gas prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries, and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass prison. Over the last two centuries, this building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. The Ghass Edifice.
Part 1.
Tehran, the Ghass Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghazni prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghazni Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fat Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
Tehrani che ma emruz ba in gostare va azamat shahedon hastim.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Ghazni Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurram Abad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure: a large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fateh Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion." In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasruddin Shah, the palace fell from grace and, abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of 3 rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty.
در همین حد زندان در دوره قاجار وجود داشت. اما بعد از رویارویی که به
But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
در فکر تأسیس یک زندان بزرگ و گسترده باشند.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications, and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the gas prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. Mohammad Farrokhi Yazdi, a well-known poet, was one of them. His revolutionary poems were so critical of the regime that he was imprisoned and his lips sewn together with needle and thread. It is widely believed he was put to death at the prison by venous air injection. In the past, there were two underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the two canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined. An idiom with a pleasant literal meaning, but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
با اخلال روبرو بشه.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in Sabak, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, SAVAK planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, "Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband." Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد
It was here that the Mossad came to help Savak, and the Mossad also established an office in Savak and began to train, equip, and exchange information with Savak.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Davud As-Sadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Sadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
در اون زمان دو نظر، دو دیدگاه و دو راه برای مبارزه وجود داشت.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of Savak agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
از سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودند.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused and then they gave me a beating.
منو میگرفتن زیر مشکلات دیگه در حد بیحال شدن منو زدن
They beat me very hard Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
تمام طول مدتی که زندانی در کمیته بود اصلا خانواده از این اطلاع نداشتن.
During the time the prisoner was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's while some families knew their children were there.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davud Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Qasr prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
برای مردم ایران توی مملکت ایجاد کرد و